Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The teenage years aren't easy. We get that. But the percentage of young people aged 12 to 20 reporting a major depressive episode in recent years has taken a real bump up, and a bigger bump for girls. Why? And what do we do about it? This hour on Point, teens and depression. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen it, felt it? What can be done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Dr. Mark Olson. He's a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center and co-author of a big study on depression in adolescents and young adults that was featured in Pediatrics, the journal. Dr. Mark Olson, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
And joining us from St. Louis in Missouri is Dr. Anne Glowinski. She's a professor of child psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. In pediatrics, she wrote a companion piece to the big study where she advocated for more psychiatric training for pediatricians. Dr. Anne Glowinski, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me, and you have a great show.
Oh, thank you very much. Dr. Olson, would you take us in first to just what you found in your study? What period were you looking at? What did you find about American teens?
So we were looking at the period between 2005 and 2014. And during that period, we found, as you indicated, there's been a rise or an increase in the proportion of adolescents who experience a clinical depression, or what we call a major depression episode, an increase during that decade of around 30%, going from 8.7% to 11.3% of adolescents. And the increase, as you indicate, was particularly apparent among girls. And another key finding to emerge from the study is that only a minority of these young people with depression are receiving treatment, and that proportion hasn't changed. So we're not making progress in terms of getting these young people the care they need.
Take us deeper into those numbers and the distinction between boys and girls. And some of the reports I'm seeing here, it looks quite remarkable how much more depression or how much more common depressive episodes are among young females than males.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, just for background, the risk of depression sharply rises as children transition into adolescence. And that increase, and we've seen this in other studies as well, is particularly prominent for girls. So by the time they're adolescents, their risk of depression is about twice as high as it is for boys.
Give us the numbers. What percentage of boys did you find in this period facing or having experienced depression, and what percentage of girls?
Well, you know, it varies at different age groups, but it's about, as I mentioned, it's about twice as high in girls than boys. So it was around, depending upon the year, about 6% or so among boys, and up in girls, it went as high as 15 or 16%.
And what ages are we talking here where you had those highs?
Well, the very highest risk was among the adolescents who were in the 16 to 17-year-old age range. We see an increase during, you know, from 12 on up, and then it sort of peaks in that age at sort of late adolescence, and then stabilizes or even declines a little bit as they reach early adulthood. I should emphasize, though, that we couldn't get into this too deeply into the mm-hmm. study, but in practice, it's clear that while depression may first become apparent during these years, many of these young people, if you look at them, they've had histories of anxiety, separation anxiety, or other kinds of social anxiety and so forth when they were younger children. So it's that the symptoms may be changing somewhat as they develop.
Could you help us, for lay people listening here, with terms here? You talk in the report about having had a major depressive episode. Is that the same as we would say having been depressed in sort of layman speak?
Well, it is, except that it's more severe and it's more persistent and more impairing. So here, when mental health professionals talk about it. They're talking about episodes that last for at least 2 weeks and that have at least five symptoms. So many of these kids will have, not only depressed mood, but they may lose interest in activities and withdraw from school. They may have disturbances in their sleep patterns. They may have difficulties making decisions. Sometimes they become more irritable. So there are a whole variety of different manifestations that we see in this population.
Dr. Glowinski, again, as a layperson listening here, to be kind of blue for a couple of weeks, I don't know what to make of that. Is that a big deal?
So you're asking whether people should worry if they're a little bit blue for 2 weeks. That's a really good question. I think that the kind of depression that Mark is talking about is not just being blue. It's a syndrome that is accompanied by other symptoms. And the most impairing, especially in adolescents, may be retreating from activities that you usually find enjoyable. So that's not going to be hanging out with your parents, but typically hanging out with your friends, for example. It's also going to be sometimes a change in your sleeping pattern, not because you're staying up at night watching TV, but also because you either can't fall asleep or can't stay asleep in the middle of the night or have a hard time waking up on time or not waking up too early. It also is going to be associated with changes in appetite. It's potentially going to be associated with thoughts about death, up to suicidal ideation, up to even trying to take your own life. It's going to be associated with changes in how you perceive yourself. So even if you're a very exuberant person who loves life, you may uncharacteristically feel that you're not adequate. You're just not a good person. You feel like a burden to others. So depression is not just sadness. It's really a constellation of many other symptoms, too.
Dr. Olson, is depression different for teens than for adults? I mean, with adults, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we talk about suffering depression, I often think in terms of adults who suffer longer term than a couple of weeks.
Yes. Well, we're talking here about the sort of the minimum period.
Okay.
But there are some differences. You know, you sometimes see in adolescence, you can see somewhat more irritability than you see in adult depression. The other thing that's typically in adult depression, you have there's often a loss of appetite here. Sometimes there's an actual increase in appetite, or sometimes, usually in adults, you see, as Emma's describing, difficulties of falling and staying asleep or waking up too early. Sometimes in children or young people, you see increased sleep and being being late for school and other activities. So there are some of these differences, but there are also some continuities between the syndromes in the two age groups.
Dr. Glowinski?
Yes, if I can follow. In adult depression, there was a term that was coined atypical to describe people who were oversleeping and also overeating and other things. But Mark is right that in adolescence, that is not atypical. That can be as typical as losing your appetite or having a hard time sleeping.
Some of these things we kind of associate with just what coming into adulthood that teenage years represent. So how does a young person or their parents or guardians know whether it's just, you know, making it through the awkwardness and difficulty of growing up, or it's a depressive episode, Dr. Glowinski?
So that's a great question. And I think that, thankfully, we have studies of adolescents that help us answer this question, because there have been many studies that have looked at what is the story in adolescence? What does adolescence look like? And for example, adolescence is associated with a sharp increase in not getting along with your parents. That's perfectly normal. It's associated in a sharp increase in being a little bit more negative. It's certainly associated, and I'm talking about in general, a lot of people don't have that typical kid, but it may be associated with wanting to be in your room, listening to music, and not interacting as much with adults that before that used to be the center of your world. But it is not associated with not liking your friends. It is not associated with dropping your hobbies that you're passionate about. It is not associated with losing weight because you're not hungry for food anymore, or ballooning because you're suddenly eating way too much. It is not associated with trying to take your own life.
You know, if I could just
jump
in here, Tom, I think the question you ask is a very good one, and I think Anne really has pointed out a number of things that sort of distinguish what we call major depression or clinical depression from a period of being an adolescent who's moody or has blues. But it can be difficult for parents, and parents who are reluctant to think of their adolescent child as having a significant mental health problem, often do chalk it up to a sort of a phase, and it's one of the things that can delay treatment and that can have adverse consequences for the young person. And so if there's doubt, it makes sense, but it can be difficult to initiate the conversation either with a pediatrician or a other healthcare professional where parents can share their concerns, and that can lead to an evaluation that can make the kind of determination you're asking about.
What percentage of young people get that kind of even just a survey from a professional?
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that. We do know that the great majority of adolescents in the course of a year touch the healthcare system. Usually it's, at a minimum, it's a school physical or a sports physical. And there have been a number of efforts over the past several years to try to promote the use of these brief screening tools that can get the assessment process started. But the uptake, I don't know that we can put a number on that.
We'll come back and look at that number. We've got a break right in front of us. Dr. Mark Olfson, Dr. Anne Glowinski, it's great to have both of you here. We're looking at depression among American teens, especially girls. Breathe Me from Sia. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Ouch.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about depression up among American teens, and especially up among teenage girls, and what to do about it. With us, Mark Olfson, Dr. Mark Olfson, a professor of psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center, a co-author of a big report that came out in the journal Pediatrics, a national study on depression in adolescents and young adults. Dr. Anne Glowinski is with us as well from St. Louis, child psychiatrist, professor of child psychiatry at Washington University's School of Medicine. She wrote a big companion piece there on treatment and more. You can join us this hour. Do you see it, this teen depression, or see the reasons why American teens might be struggling with depression? Do you see it in your own circle, your own community, your own family, your own child, yourself? And how do you think about whether it's just moodiness, teenage angst, or something more? What do you think is going on here with this increase between the years, this happened to be between 2004 and 2015? In February last year, ABC's 2020 interviewed 15-year-old Bailey, a high schooler who struggles with depression and has attempted suicide. Here's what she said.
It was hard going through high school as it is. There's so many changes. People around me were just happy all the time. Being me, it was like I couldn't even fit into them at all. I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I had to force myself to shower and do the little things that seemed like it was so easy for everyone else to do.
Tough. And it's not just girls, of course. Last month, ABC interviewed 23-year-old Drew Bergman of Mount Holly, New Jersey. Drew attempted suicide twice as a teenager. Now he helps depressed teens through a suicide education group called Minding Your Mind.
It felt like every ounce of me was 10 times heavier. Like, just to get out of bed every morning, I had to literally drag myself. I was so scared of what people would say, what people would think if they knew what I had actually gone through.
There, Dr. Olson and Dr. Glubinsky, please stand by. Callers on this front, let's go right to Champaign, Illinois, and Meg. Meg, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What's your story?
Well, I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder when I was 16. That was in 2007. I'm 25 now.
Okay.
And I am still suffering from depression, so I've kind of seen how it transitions from adolescent depression into adult depression.
May, can you go back and share with us, if you care to, how you and your family and whatever medical professionals figured out what was going on?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of difficult actually because I went to a school for high school. It was a boarding school. I won't, you know, share the name because they might get mad at me. But it was, you know, it was built to be a very rigorous institution academically. And so I was kind of surrounded by kids who were stressed out all the time.
Okay.
And so it was difficult to separate that, you know, just like normal, you know, homework stress and whatever from, you know, an actual mental illness. But I think that what, you know, what really set it off, you know, for me to go and get diagnosed was, it's just the fact that, you know, when it gets to a certain point where it's interfering with nearly everything you do and, you know, like in that interview you just played, you can't get out of bed and you can't, you know, you just feel this way for what seems like no reason and it's inescapable. It just kind of eats you up and you can't get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and then I kind of knew it's like, this isn't normal. This isn't how I should be feeling.
Who pulled the ripcord here? Was it you who said, I got to talk to a doctor? Was it your parents? Was it a counselor?
I think it might have been a little of both. I think it was me, and then my parents just kind of agreed, you know, because they had been worried too. But they just didn't have any experience with this kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, they hadn't really
who does?
Dealt
I mean,
with
many don't.
Mental health treatments, yeah.
And so did you get good treatment? You were in boarding school. It sounds like you weren't in poverty. How did it work out?
Well, it was actually the kind of boarding. It was like it's a publicly funded boarding school.
Okay.
So we weren't, we were not rich.
Okay.
But yeah, I did. I mean, we, you know, it wasn't like a jail or something. We weren't locked in all the time. So I was able to go and see a psychiatrist and start getting treatment, you know, in the form of both medication and, you know, regular therapy, and it really started to help. And I think the most difficult part about it between now and then has been kind of, you know, as I've moved and relocated and my life situation has changed, having to change doctors can be really difficult, especially with the insurance is usually pretty limited in terms of the number of psychiatrists they'll cover.
And how, when you look back on it now, what would have made your life easier? Is there something that might have, you know, kept you from getting depressed in the first place? Or what would you like to have changed?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think there was. I think that, you know, it's just something that's, you know, it's like having any other illness. You can't always do anything about it. It's just there. I mean, if there was something that could have stopped me from getting depressed in the first place, I could have fixed it by now. You know, but I'm still dealing with it.
Is it better now, Meg, or are you better at dealing with it?
It depends on what day it is. I actually had a pretty significant bout of it over the summer. There were a good couple months when I was, you know, nearly debilitated with it. But more generally, I'm very functional.
Yeah.
But I still have bad days now and then.
What's your advice to parents listening and wondering about their own son or daughter and thinking what to do or how to weigh their circumstances?
Well, like I mentioned, I think what set it off for me was the fact that when it started really interfering with everything that I needed to do, you know, homework and extracurriculars and sleeping, I've always had trouble with sleeping. Then, you know, you've kind of crossed the line from general, like, teenage hormonal mood swings into something bigger. And, you know, the key is just to be understanding. Unfortunately, there are a lot of, I've had friends who've had parents who just, you know, they say, oh, you just need to, you know, pick yourself up and stop, you know, just get over it. And you can't. It's not possible.
Mm-hmm. Meg, I really appreciate your sharing that story with us, your story with us. And I'm grateful for it. And I wish you well. I wish you very well, Meg.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Glowinski, what do you hear in Meg's story?
So I think I hear a lot, and including the fact that she provides just a very honest and brave account of what it was like for her.
Yeah.
And I also want to say that every depression is a little bit different. So, for example, to the question of, is there anything that you can do to prevent it? In general, if, for example, you have a family history of depression, and it looks like you're carrying a genetic vulnerability, I think that we would recommend, you know, trying to sleep well and exercise and eat well and trying to avoid stress. Obviously, it's easier said than done. And I'm saying that because there is a relationship between trauma exposure and adverse events and then the development of anxiety, as Mark was alluding to, and then depression. So there really is an interaction in terms of what puts you at risk between what you're born with and then also sort of what happens to you. And not only that, but other factors interfere. So, for example, the temperament that you have, you know, some, you, I don't know if you have children, but some babies are born with a very resilient temperament and things that happens to them just rolls off their shoulders. And other kids take setbacks more at heart. So if you sort of think about that trifecta of having genes for depression, having a predisposition to have a hard time when bad things happen to you, and then bad things happen to you, happening to you, then you're going to be at greater risk. And one of the tragedy in America and in other countries is that there are kids who are at enormous risk of adverse events, and those risks are correlated, you know, so they might live in a neighborhood where the schools are not good and where the parents are not as attuned and where basically it's going to be harder for them to have a support system and where bad people are going to do certain things to them. So that particular kid, if he or she has vulnerability, the probability that they will get depression is very high. So in theory, we could have a society that minds that and tries to prevent. I do believe we could do much better to prevent depression. But Meg is also right that at some level, it can feel like a force of nature, and it would be sort of like saying, you got cancer, could you have avoided it? Or you had diabetes, could you have avoided it? So it's both a force of nature, but they're also, in the general population, things that probably lead to the development of depression, and we could do a better job preventing those.
Dr. Olson, how do you explain the fact that the rate went up during this period so markedly? Is that typical? Do we know from earlier studies? I mean, why would a nation suddenly have more depressed teens, in this case between 2004 and 2015? You know, something in the air, the water, the culture, the why?
You know, I don't think we yet know why that is. And this study certainly didn't have a means of elucidating that. So we can only really kind of guess at it. One of the things that's happened over the last several years is that adolescents are relying more and more on their mobile phones and texting applications, and that's brought a rise in cyberbullying. It appears to be more prevalent in girls than boys, and that may be a kind of an environmental stress that's evolving and that's new. But that doesn't seem, you know, like a fully adequate explanation. One of the other thought that we had is that maybe substance abuse, because we know that substance abuse, drugs and alcohol used in excess can put young people at risk. But
that's been around a long time, and I thought that in general that was down among American teens.
It has. I was getting that. That's right. And so that isn't an that's an idea that might occur to one, but it isn't an adequate explanation. So we really, I don't think anyone knows. It's certainly, this study spans a period of time where we've had a great, you know, financial stress associated with the Great Recession starting in 2008. And even though the economy has recovered from that, some families' resources have been depleted during that time. But even but the patterning with particularly a slightly greater increase among white young people than among African Americans wouldn't be consistent with that explanation. So we don't really have an adequate explanation for why this should be. I will say, though, that, and it's a different but related phenomenon that's much, thankfully, much less common, but that we've also seen during the same period an increase in the rates of suicide, both among boys and girls in this same age range. So it may be part of a larger story that we're still really grasping.
Do you know how American rates of teen depression compare to those of other countries, industrialized or otherwise?
Well, there's more information on industrialized countries than there are on lower income countries. And my understanding of the literature, and Anna can add to this, is that they're toward the high end, but they're not at the very high end. So they're kind of where you would expect them to be.
All right. All right. Interesting. I want to bring in Catherine Steiner Adair, child psychologist, joining us from New York, works with girls, adolescents. She's author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relations in the Digital Age. Catherine Steiner Adair, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
You point to social media and you say there is a problem there. What?
Well, let me say it's different to say there's a problem there than to say this is causing rather than correlated with depression. But the whole experience of being a teenage girl today is so dramatically different from what, you know, those of us who are parents of teenagers certainly experienced. Because on the one hand, what's wonderful about technology is kids have 24/7 access to one another. And you know, they're doing a lot of wonderful things connecting online. They're helping each other out. They're helping each other out with homework. They're actually saving each other's lives sometimes when kids are depressed, because someone will post an emo post and they'll go to a trusted adult, hopefully at their school or parents, and say, hey, I'm worried about this kid. So let me just say that there's so much good stuff going on, but the bad stuff is really bad. For most of us, when we went to school, the drama was at school. And then we went home, and home was relatively quiet. It was
sometimes a refuge.
Absolutely. You know, you'd call your friend on the phone, you'd watch TV. Well, kids today go home, and they're away from their teachers, who at school are reminding them to be their better selves, and they connect online. And some of the social networking sites they are on have values that are very much the opposite of school values and family values. It's cool to be cruel on many social networking sites. You actually get more likes and followers if you're snarky. It's a culture where you get popularity, you know, likes, followers, whatever, if you post a humiliating photo of somebody. It's a world in which, you know, at school we say be real, be authentic, where people pretend to be people they are not. They hack or they start rumors. And, you know, it's very tough because this also plays to the vulnerability of adolescents in their own psychological development, the stage of life. So, you know, sites like Snapchat that are so neurologically compelling and designed to be so are, you know, causing enormous pain and suffering, you know, whether that is necessarily linked to this.
But also joy and laughter. I've seen lots of...
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, that's the paradox. It's great and it's sometimes not so great.
I mean, we're looking for a reason as to why we might have seen this increase during this period, and I have no idea, but it is certainly the period, 2004 to 2015, in which American culture became inundated with social media. That's almost a precise overlap of the two. So are you making a claim here, Catherine?
No, I'm not making a claim, but I'm making a call for schools and educators and pediatricians and parents to pay a lot more attention to the tools we give kids for coping with being adolescents in the digital age. And schools need to approach this differently. Teachers certainly need to be trained to pick up early signs of depression, of kids losing interest in school, sort of the subclinical signs, kids who look stressed out, who are disengaged, who are overwhelmed, who aren't doing homework, who are falling asleep in class. We have to do a lot more frontline early intervention because we have more kids requiring help than we have adequate staffing and counselors in schools to reach out.
We'd like to have a culture where that wasn't the case, a society where that wasn't the case, but we're looking at the facts.
as they are here. We're talking about depression up among American teens and especially up among girls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Regina Spektor here. We'll be right back.
It's like forgetting the words to your favorite song. You can't believe it. You were always singing along. It was so easy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about depression up among American teens and especially up among teenage girls and what to do about it. We're talking with Dr. Mark Olson. He joins us from New York. Dr. Ang Lewinsky from St. Louis. Catherine Steiner-Adair, clinical psychologist with us from New York as well. And you can join us this hour. What do you think is going on here? We've got numbers that are arresting. Numbers up to 6% of boys, 15% or more of girls. Did you have teen depression? What worked for you? And can we just talk about this openly now? Is there still a stigma? Lots of callers here. Evelyn in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Evelyn, thank you very much for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would like to say that I think in general we're lacking a lot of services in our community and surrounding communities because Kentucky is very rural. I also work in therapeutic foster care, and it seems like our children experience a lot of trauma. And on top of things, our teachers and educators aren't really trained to deal with those behaviors. So then I think that there's higher rates of depression and also other diagnoses on top of that. And I think social media also plays a big factor into that as well.
Do you run into kids in foster care regularly who are suffering what looks to you like depression? Are you trained to know, Evelyn?
Somewhat trained. I only have a bachelor's degree, so that's something that we would work with a therapist on.
Okay.
But
yep.
I think that they are, of course, all depressed. They've had so many traumatic things happen in their lives that we can't even comprehend.
And what about the way you're seeing them being treated or not treated?
I think that there's just, like, for example, psychiatric med management, things like that is very lacking in our community. So that's kind of hard to get the help that they need for medication management and things like that.
And what seems to you to work or not work? What do you think about treatment that you do see?
I think that if the child is willing to work through their issues with depression and things like that, then obviously they can overcome it. But sometimes they're not willing to confront that yet in their lives because they are adolescents. So how do you motivate a 15-year-old to talk about depression when they don't want to?
Yeah, Evelyn, I appreciate your report kind of from the front lines there. And thank you very much for that. Dr. Lewinsky, what about what works and what's needed when a child, a teenager runs into this? How much can parents do or be helpful with? And how much needs more than that?
Right. So I think I would like to comment on the issue of stigma because I think it's a little bit the elephant in the room in this situation. So when Evelyn talks about a kid who needs help desperately and doesn't feel ready for help, there may be several reasons. So like she mentions, they may have had a history of trauma and that can make opening up very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a big stigma. And so when we're talking about the behavior of teachers, pediatricians, parents, and youth, all these behaviors can be affected by stigma. There are many studies that show that even if people understand what depression is, it doesn't mean that they accept it as something that is just like any other illness. And in particular, what's very fascinating is that people associate treated depression with a greater load of stigma. So it's almost like if you hear the narrative, you know, people will say, oh, yes, I have depression, but I'm not taking medicine, or, oh, yes, I had depression, but I got over it. So it's almost like it certainly is more acceptable to talk about depression. But the idea of treatment is still very terrifying because it almost implies like you're not strong enough, you're defective enough that you actually are at that level. And obviously, from our point of view, if you have depression and it's severe enough, the treated person is going to do a whole lot better. I think if you remember Meg, she said she was functional most of the time, even if she has hard days. It would be much harder for her without treatment. So I think that that is something that we have to address. And so in a sense, part of the effort to change things would really require all these segments that, that constitute the village, so to speak, of the adolescent and the adolescent not having behavior that is, in a way, driven by stigma as much.
I mean, Dr. Olson, cards on the table. I remember at age, 14 or so, having a very depressed period. It was about this time of year, you know, and it's deep of winter. And it just came on me as I'm thinking about it as we speak here. I'd never felt this way before. It felt to me in layman's terms like I was suddenly deeply depressed. It was really unnerving, but I would have had very little idea what to do about it exactly, except just to live through it. I mean, how do kids even, you know, they don't have a lot of experience in the world. They're not trained to think about these things or to ask about these things. I just kind of I guess I just suffered through it, and somehow it worked out. But it was I experienced it as something unique, very distinctive, and very upsetting at that time, and something new I'd never felt before.
You know, I think you're probably not alone in having had an experience like that. And one of the things, you know, we talk and think a lot about educating pediatricians and family practitioners to try to improve their detection and management of depression. But there's also a piece that could be happening in the schools around health education and mental health literacy that isn't occurring in very many school districts, so that if young people experience these things, they'd have a name for it, and they'd realize this is something that is a condition that can be helped. So I think that that's something, that's another way in which, if we're thinking about sort of broad strategies to approach this growing problem, that there's an opportunity there to make some progress. I want to, if I could, just loop back to one thing that Evelyn mentioned about her experience in Kentucky about the lack of specialists. I think that's one of the key challenges that we face, that not only is there an absolute shortage of mental health specialists who work with children, but there's a problem in their distribution. They're kind of all bunched up, or most of them, I should say, are bunched up in urban and suburban areas. So we also face some, as a nation, some real challenges in getting the mental health specialty care that's needed to the places where it's needed.
What happens when a teenager or with their parents goes in and says, I think I have a problem? What happens? I mean, people are listening right now to you, Dr. Olson, and maybe they're wondering, should I go seek treatment of some kind, but may not know, oh boy, what is that set in train? What happens?
Well, you know, I think it depends. Oftentimes the first discussion is with the pediatrician or the family practitioner. And to be honest with you, Tom, there's a wide range of variability in how skilled and confident and even, frankly, interested pediatricians are in this issue. I think over time there has been progress with a greater interest and greater acceptance among pediatricians and other primary care providers that this is part of their role, to be on the front lines to help detect depression, and for the more severe cases to help them into especially mental health care if it's available.
But are they going to, Dr. Glewinski, are they going to be offered medication right away? I mean, here's a listener online says, I'm a psychotherapist and I see teens in my practice. One of the biggest obstacles to treating depression, writes to us, in this population is parents' reluctance or refusal to treat the depression with medication. Maybe that's related to stigma. Maybe they just don't want to go down that road. Maybe they want their child to tough through it. I don't know. But how soon does that come up?
Right. So I think we're talking about the correlation of several things. So as Mark mentioned, The encounter that you have with your pediatrician is going to be very varied. I think that it's true that pediatricians are recognizing that it's their role. But because this is not yet an important part of their curriculum or a required part of their curriculum, I mean, it's they have adolescent medicine rotations and they have developmental pediatric rotations, but a lot is going on in these rotations. They don't have a child psychiatry rotation where basically they see a lot of kids with depression and anxiety. Exactly. So my experience as a doctor is that if I don't know how to do something, and this is true for anybody, I'm not as comfortable. So I would say that in general, we see a lot of avoidance of screening by pediatricians who are not trained. If the parents or the child are directly mentioning that they have depression, I think it is more likely than not that something might happen, but sometimes the pediatrician is very overwhelmed.
But what's that something that's going to happen? Will they send the child to a therapist to talk with the child? Suddenly whip out a prescription pad and say, here's Xanax? So, I don't know.
Exactly, not Xanax, but I think
no idea.
You're pointing out something really important. What happens is actually really important to the parent. So if I'm a parent and I'm already sort of on thin ice because I'm worried about stigma and stigmatization. And
doing more harm than good somehow.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I see a pediatrician who seems overwhelmed. I'm reading that and they're pushing for medication or they're not giving me the psychoeducation that would be reassuring about the illness. It may push me even further in my attitude. I can tell you, obviously, my bread and butter is seeing kids with severe depression. Mm-hmm. I am so comfortable having these talks with parents. I don't think I've ever seen a parent who came and said, please put my child on medicine. If they did, I would be worried.
What percentage of the kids you see end up on medication? How common
so
is
I
that?
I have a very skewed clinic. I see people who have typically struggled for years, often tried other things. Mm-hmm. So
I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just curious.
No. I'm just telling you. I'm not representative. Okay. The vast majority of the people I see
so you have the tough
need
cases.
Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
The tough cases, and 5% maybe don't. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority take medicine for at least 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Kayla in Dayton, Ohio. Kayla, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to kind of give my story. I have exhibited anxiety and depression from the age of 10 until probably, I mean, currently I still struggle with a little bit of depression, but I think, you know, exhibiting self-harm behaviors and that kind of thing my teens.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest thing was not getting help and having help be a threat. And therapy, what your guest has been talking about, and the stigma behind therapy was, I think, a big barrier of me getting any help. Because
help as a threat, meaning like, Kayla, pull yourself together or we're going to send you to therapy?
Exactly. If I see that you harm again, then we'll have to take you to the therapist as a threat instead of as a way to get me better.
What helped, Kayla? What helped for you?
I think a whole lot of different life experiences and I did medication, I did therapy, and I think it was just a combination of a lot of things. I still struggle with anxiety, I still struggle with some depression, but not to the degree I did from the ages of 10 to 21.
Can you talk to people about it, and they're okay with it, or do they like, oh boy, here goes Kayla on her?
No, I'm really open about it. I wear my heart on my sleeve about it because I think it's important to talk about. It's important to get the stigma of mental health.
Amen.
To do away with it.
Yeah. Hey, Kayla, our time is short, and I appreciate your call. Catherine Steiner-Adair, if you see social media driving some of this, look at that arena with us for a minute. You've thought a lot about it. What helps to rein in the downside of that realm, and if it's pushing some teens, maybe girls, into depression, what do you advise?
Well, I think very early on we have to start teaching kids about the effects of tech on their brain and how when we're not the same person when we're texting, and neurologically we say and do and act in ways many of us wouldn't do face to face.
What do you mean we're not the same person when we're texting?
Well, you know, we lose our filter. You put texting in the hands of 10, 11, 12-year-olds are much more likely to text something like the letter U, letter R, fat, you are not my friend. Most kids, you know, we become disinhibited. The stimulant of texting itself to our brains makes us want to do it more, do it faster. We have to really help kids understand what the values are in certain social networking sites. We have to help kids understand that when you don't see the impact of your words on the other person, you might be meaner with anonymity. Mm-hmm. And we have to really teach children that there's often a disconnect between who they are face-to-face and how they connect online, and certain social networking sites call for them and reward them for being unkind.
This
and
sounds
that's
like it ought to be
cool.
A unit in every middle school in the country, you know?
It should be a unit in every grade.
Okay.
Not just middle school, because it gets more complicated, and then you have hookup culture, and you have a lot of misogyny, a lot of racism. You have a lot of mean-spirited stuff across the board, and girls often take the brunt of it. And the other thing that, you know, we really have to think about is, what are the messages to girls and women right now in our country about owning your body, respect for your body, being loved for who you are?
Yes.
This is a pretty hard time for girls and women right now. But the other thing I want to say that I think, because I tend to work more in schools and in sort of prevention and reintegration, is one of the things that schools, I think, are looking at and doing a better job. In fact, I actually live in Boston. Brookline High School is a model program. Is that once a child leaves school, takes a medical leave of absence, one of the most difficult things is reentry, coming back to school. And we have to develop much better crisis support and reintegration opportunities for kids.
Open arms, open hearts, understanding.
Yeah, the stigmatizing in the hall, but also have teachers understand, you know what, this is real. This kid cannot make up every single assignment, take every single exam they missed. We really want to have both faculty-led crisis identification and early identification, which isn't to say teachers should ever diagnose a child, but they should be better trained to look for signs that a kid is slipping into some kind of depression or anxiety disorder or just isolation. And on the other side, we really need to think about how we can wrap our arms around kids and make coming back to school and the structure and the routine much more user-friendly for these kids who've been through a hard time.
Hey, this is a tough subject, but this has been a really interesting hour. To any family or teen out there struggling with it, you hang in there, get the care you need, and forget the stigma. Just go for it. I want to thank all three of my guests today for being with us. Absolutely fascinating. Dr. Anne Glowinski at Washington University School of Medicine, joining us from St. Louis. Dr. Glowinski, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Mark Olfson at Columbia University Medical Center, who was a co-author on this big study. Thank you very much, Dr. Olfson.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Catherine Steiner Adair, you're terrific. Come again. Thanks very much for joining us. The book is The Big Disconnect. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
My pleasure.
We'll go out with Florence and the Machine. Shake it out. Shake it out. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You hang in there. This is On Point.